Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You are listening to Total EM. My podcast today is one that I have been thinking about and finally pulled the trigger after reading some recent articles and thought this is something that obviously is not getting out there because everyone's talking about it, but really no one's talking about it at the same time. And that is about PPE in the case of opiate exposures. This is something that we've heard a little bit from, but especially you're going to hear about it in the lay press. And you've heard about it in the lay press so much that I've had nurses, medics, it doesn't matter who, even other colleagues such as other PAs, NPs, and physicians who have freaked out now because they've read these case reports about someone who wasn't responding to naloxone after they had been exposed because of the potent doses. But really, if you read the toxicology literature and what they've done to back this up, this is missing a lot of important details. And particularly, a lot of the lay press articles and publications lack the facts and the key points that would actually really give us what we need to know to better understand if this truly was an opiate overdose or if this was someone's imagination going a little wild. Now, this is not to demean anyone. This is not to say that these people didn't have something happen to them, but simply that these are circumstances which don't really add up. And we need to talk about this more because I'm even starting to see this in some of the departments that I work with or work for, where we have now gone well beyond what we probably need to do as far as protection because we're bastardizing what is currently out there. So what I want to do today is just kind of give a brief explanation of the pharmacodynamics and some of the research that is out there, actual peer-reviewed research and details and papers that we really aren't paying attention to. And some of this old literature is incredibly old. We're talking about from the 90s or even earlier or later, but some of this is also much newer than that. And what we need to do is we need to recognize that this is, in a sense, an old problem, but with some new kind of twist to it because of what we're seeing. So when we talk about some of the stories, a lot of times they focus on emergency responders, particularly law enforcement. In fact, on the show notes, we talk a little bit about that, included a link to a couple of these said articles. But again, we're missing out on what the toxicologists are talking about. And what we forget is that we probably come in contact with these substances more often than we realize, but at the same time, they're not at significant levels. In fact, the inadvertent contact with opiate substances would be highly unlikely, and that a poisoning would be incredibly rare. This is largely due to the poor absorption of these opiates through the skin. Now, people want to talk about fentanyl patches and stuff like that. Fentanyl patches are highly unique and different than what we are talking about when we see pills. And this is what people are talking about, the fentanyl powder or pills or however you see these drugs in the environment. That's going to be a heck of a lot different than what we're actually seeing in these patches that are being used by patients for their chronic conditions or what have you. Not to say that patches aren't abused. I've seen that plenty of times too. But what I'm talking about here is that a patch gets absorbed extremely different from the skin than just a piece of tablet or the powder or whatever being on your skin. And we actually need to appreciate this because this actually makes it very easy for us to treat because even if you were exposed with direct skin contact with one of these powders or the tablets or what have you, it would take an incredibly slow time for it to be absorbed and especially to get anywhere near a toxic dose, which is why we got to think about this in this degree because simple protection of the skin, simple protection such as nitrile gloves, which is what most groups recommend. Simply using nitrile gloves will go a long way in protection. You don't need anything crazy. You don't need to buy any sort of special gloves. I know there are gloves out there on the market that are talking about using this because it has extra thickness and blah, blah, blah. And we've seen this in again, in departments that we work with or for. But they really need it, probably not, because simply, again, the pharmacodynamics, If you get it on your gloves, if you're that concerned about it, take off the gloves and put a new pair on. You don't have to have these super thick, you know, basically rubber gloves when all you need is a good nitrile glove that isn't completely torn apart. And even if that were to happen, even if you had a tear in your gloves and you had direct exposure to this, wash your hands. Don't use alcohol wipes or hand sanitizer based with alcohol in them or stuff like that. Properly wash your hands. Part of this is because the hand sanitizer isn't really going to do anything because you're not washing it off your skin. And you might actually increase the absorption some because of the heat and stuff like that. So probably just best to avoid the hand sanitizers in this particular role. But again, you get exposed, wash your hands. You should be washing your hands anyway. Simple as that. This is just good hygiene. But use of nitrile gloves plus washing your hands will combat most of these issues. Okay, so we got that beat down. The skin is okay. The skin, as long as it's intact and everything like that, you know, basically regular working conditions, you should be fine. What about ocular and facial exposures? Basically, when you get to the mucous membranes. Now, this is an increased absorption rate. We're talking about a 30-fold increase. So we definitely don't want to have this in your mouth if possible, which is why some people, when they overdose and stuff, it's because they shot in their mouths. But again, this is incredibly rare. Let's talk about a case report about a veterinarian who basically was using a dart that contained carfentanil and xylazine. And basically that dart, some of the chemical got splashed in his mouth. He cleaned the area, but within a couple of minutes, he starts to feel drowsy and was properly given naltrexone. He had a good benefit. We don't really know if this was actually from the carfentanil, but this is about the only real good case report that I've seen. And in this case, again, patient does well, and we're not exactly sure, but okay, maybe this could have been an issue. But again, more mild and more self-resolving. You could argue that the naltrexone helps with that. I'm not going to dispute that. But again, this is a pretty rare exposure. And guess what? If you want to avoid that, wear a mask. But how often are you going to be at risk for a splash? More likely, this is going to be with law enforcement when they're doing testing or stuff like that. Or again, these unique settings where you're working around these chemicals. But this is probably not going to be, again, during the opiate overdose patient who has, I don't know, maybe they're in a factory and they're making stuff. That would be an entirely different circumstance altogether, which actually leads to the next part about inhalation. Inhalation is probably the actual time that I'm going to be worried about it. This inhalation, though, you have to be in a pretty unique circumstance because, yes, the bioavailability could be up to 100% in circumstances, but the vapor pressure is very low, so it's not a gaseous product that is going to happen with this when it evaporates or whatever, but it's more likely to be in an enclosed environment with a high level of exposure. The best case report for this, and if you ever notice, toxicology is basically case reports medicine. It's probably the one place where you can get away with that the most. But there's a great case report of a theater in 2002 in Moscow, which they were trying to subdue the hostage takers, but about 125 people died as a result. And when they did some testing of the clothing, urine materials, so on and so forth, basically found traces of carfentanil mixed in with it, which is probably what actually killed these people. But again, they're in an enclosed environment with a high volume of this. So this is very different than the environment we're seeing. Maybe if you're a first responder, you go into, again, this factory that's producing stuff and there's an explosion and you get all this dust in you that contains carfentanil or fentanyl or what have you. Maybe in that case, but even in that case, with what we see, more likely than not, an N95 mask is going to be more than enough. And partly when we think about exposures too, it still takes quite a bit. If you follow the industry regulations for production of, say, fentanyl, for example, even at the upper limits of exposure, at the highest airborne concentration allowed, it would take 200 minutes of exposure to reach a dose of 100 micrograms of fentanyl while entirely unprotected. 200 minutes. If you're in a situation that long, because that's about basically 3 1/3 hours, that's again, incredibly rare. Not saying not to wear masks if the environment is one that you need to do that, but you probably don't have to do it on the day-to-day basis. You go into an overdose situation, you don't have to wear an N95 mask or something else. Hell, you like SCBAs because, you know, on the fire department side of things, that's what we were. We were SCBAs because that's the first thing we've got. You don't need that type of protection. Again, in most of these circumstances, you won't need it at all. But if it makes you feel better, you can keep it around, have it on the ready just in case. But again, nitrile gloves is probably going to be your main part. Nitrile gloves and hand washing. No matter what the route of exposure, though, what we're actually looking for and what we're trying to treat is the respiratory depression and the hypoxemia. I cannot stress that enough. We are treating the respiratory depression and hypoxemia. Because the little drowsy effect and stuff like that's probably not a big deal. And if you try and treat for that goal, you're probably going to screw up because that's not actually what exactly you're going for. Given if they get super altered and then they go into respiratory depression, hypoxemia, now I'm worried about it. The initial management is going to be naloxone. There are, again, very limited case reports about dosing. There's some with 12 milligrams up to 14 milligrams in one case that I found. That's quite a bit. You can easily use up your code cart and then some trying to use all this naloxone. In fact, I was in a similar situation where we used almost twice that amount. And we did actually get ROSC briefly, but this was not a patient that survived in the end. But this was one case where maybe you can even use more. But ultimately, if you're getting at that high of amount, you're probably not getting any more benefit. And you should focus on the key, which is, again, addressing the respiratory depression, hypoxemia. So advanced airway management, especially intubation, is going to be something that you need to do. Now, that doesn't mean you have to intubate everyone, but simply this is what you're addressing. And don't waste a whole lot of time with naloxone. If you're using that much, they probably are in that bad of shape. You should have already been dealing with the airway, which in that case, we were already doing that and we have with other similar situations. But again, don't waste a whole lot of naloxone. If it's not improving your patient, you probably don't need to keep using it and focus on the other key facts. Part of that too is it may not be the opiates that's knocking them down alone. There could be other stuff involved. So don't waste all the naloxone when this probably doesn't actually have any real benefit for these patients. Okay, so in summary, let's kind of hit the key points. Again, with opiate overdoses, it's incredibly rare for someone to take care of them to then become poison themselves or overdose or however you want to put it. But such cases, it usually takes prolonged exposure, and it's probably stuff where you probably should have already been preparing for such an environment. And again, an enclosed environment with a lot of powder, yeah, you probably should have been wearing a mask anyway, but your typical routine overdose, you don't need to wear coveralls, you don't need to wear a mask, you don't need to wear all this other stuff, probably just gloves, and then, again, good hygiene, hand washing, not that hard, you can do that. And remember, you're washing with water, you're not using alcohol-based hand sanitizers. That's going to be totally defeating the purpose of what you need to do. You need to properly wash this all off. And again, use OSHA-approved eye and face protection if you're worried about mucous membrane exposure. And then again, a mask. An N95 mask is all you really need based on what evidence we have currently, that you don't need everything else. Like, you could use a P100 mask, but you don't need to. Hell, you could use an SCBA, but you really don't need to use that unless you have other things going on you're worried about. So in that case, your average routine overdose patient, stick with what you've been doing. Nitrile gloves, proper hand washing. Simple as that. In fact, I would even say that the main thing about all of this is to be safe. Scene safety is key. And remember, scene safety is still something that's happening in the emergency department. This is not just the pre-hospital side. Because keep in mind that even when these patients come in, they may not have been appropriately decontaminated. And that decontamination is a key part of all this. If you are, especially in a pre-hospital setting, Work with a partner. It's always important that you're buddied up. This is going to naturally happen in the ED, but in the pre-hospital environment, you need to be partnered up and you need to keep an eye on your partner. You almost kind of use each other for getting help and figure out what's going on, but keep an eye out for other dangers. Don't spend so much time focused on potential opiate poisoning that you forget about the other stuff, because more likely there's another threat besides the drugs themselves. All right, we have obviously hit this hard. This is something that I've wanted to talk about for a while, and after reading some papers and realizing no one else is talking about it, thought, man, we really need to get some content out there on this. If you like this, and I've had other people who've been responding recently saying they love some of the new podcasts and some of the things we talked about, great, please let me know that. And better yet, even rate us on iTunes, give us a review. All those things help us out. But just share in general. I don't care how you share. Just get the information out there. Let your colleagues know about this, because I can almost guarantee you that when you're listening to this, there's probably someone in your department or agency who is not aware of these new updates. Even if you've sent them out in emails or put something up on a wall, people probably don't realize this, and they've heard what the lay media and the lay press say, and next thing they know, they're freaking out about this, and they're going to not understand fully what's going on. Again, as I mentioned at the very beginning, there are some toxicology papers out there where we have all those kind of things in the show notes along with other stuff. Just go to them, because you're going to find a whole lot of great info, and they're going to talk a lot more about certain aspects that basically I'm not an expert on and I'm not going to claim to be an expert on, but you need to hear this information. You need to share it as much as possible. All right. So until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.